So are we dealing now actually with gods and godlings created by human fancy? Are we dealing with fabulous beings living in another world beside the shores of the air that have a real subsistence just with the infirmities we know? Or are these reports of something that came dimly to the memory of primitive man from some distant contact that he once had? Let us see what happens under such conditions in more recent times. When Cortes arrived in Mexico, he was not received as a man, but as a god. Word was taken that he was a divine being. He was not human. And the ancient Indians prostrated themselves and, in symbol of homage, placed his foot upon their heads. They reported men coming from the sky and from the sea and from the air. And when the Spanish rode horses, the Indians said they were centaurs, firmly believing in their early writings in the post-conquest period that the Spaniard and his horse were one creature. If as late as that this can happen, what could happen in the dawn of memory? What could happen in things that were old women's tales thousands of years before primitive man even tried to record them? There are these legends, these myths that have come down, distorted, but inevitably survived. And they all seem to possess the same basic pattern. And they seem to suggest that this world of the gods that in every mythology preceded mankind, in every region and in every area, that this was a kind of real world, a world that some way preceded the kind of civilization and culture that we know now. This was a world of splendor, of great glory, of wealth, and of power. It was a world also of tremendous authority, and perhaps of strange and wonderful arts and sciences, because these so-called supernatural powers that are always attributed to the gods, this power to sit upon his throne and launch his thunderbolts, accredited to Zeus, and later to the Latin Jove, these things may also be memories, memories of a power or knowledge that once existed. We have been so indifferent in our search for the sources of knowledge that we have been perfectly willing to attribute them to some happy or unhappy mortal within the memory of our own history. We have never really sought to find out the beginnings of our own knowledge. We find somewhere in history a man who stood up and said something remarkable, so we decide that he invented it and let it rest at that. But the moment we begin to investigate these claims, we find that this modest man made no such pretension. And all our arts and sciences apparently originated within the sanctuaries of ancient religion. And these sanctuaries are also the sources of these legends. And according to the same groups of legends, these arts and sciences descended from the gods. They were not invented by men at all. Or if they were, they were invented in some remote time by these strange heroic shadows who have become considered semi or totally divine. Perhaps this is the mystery of how polytheism or pantheism came into man's religious life. Man in himself, contemplating the inner mystery of his own consciousness, seeks forever one God. Yet the legends of his background speak always of many gods, of deities good and evil, and of the wars between them, and the endless strife that distorted even the heaven worlds of ancient times. Next as important is, perhaps, the realization that whether it be in the heart of Africa, or whether it be in ancient America or Asia, there is always a relationship between the rise of mortal governments and the gods. Practically every important ruling house of antiquity claimed its descent from divine beings. They ruled by divine right, They ruled because in the dawn of things they had been strangely sanctified in some way, as Abraham was sanctified by the Prince of Peace. They seemed to feel or claim that they had been of a divine blood, that they had come from the gods, and that behind the human dynasty is the semi-mythological dynasty of deities, as in Japan, going back and back and back beyond Jimmu Temu, the first of the mortal emperors. Godlings going back to the sun, to the earth, to the moon, the great Rajput houses of India claiming their descent from Rama, the sun god, or Surya, the solar orb itself, or any one of the great spiritual authorities that belong to the age of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, to the great age of myths. Now, we've already mentioned the relationship of this age of myths to our Atlantic problem, and I think we are fully justified in beginning to contemplate this broad picture of a world that attained to a considerable degree of advancement long ago, and that this advancement was blocked, stamped out, destroyed, but that the memory of it lingered on and will always continue to linger. And because of this, memory has become an essential part of the spiritual, intellectual, moral, and even physical lives of practically everyone who has lived since that time. That from these have come the symbols and the great teachings and the great beliefs. Now, in the light of the same thing, let us assume for a moment that we are seeking to discover the axis or the central theme of the Atlantean culture. We have, of course, so little to go on, but we have something. And we have a number of points that are of interest to us. What was the great religious symbol among the Atlanteans? We have every reason to believe, from what we know, that to them, the serpent was the symbol of God. We have also reason to believe that, as was later used by the Egyptians and several of the early Phoenician historians and Roman historians were convinced, as we mentioned before, that the Egyptians were the Atlanteans who could not go home because of the destruction of their land after their invasion of Athens, or attempt to invade Athens. The royal symbol of the Egyptians was the serpent coiled upon the forehead of the solar crown. And in the crowning of the Egyptian pharaoh, the crown of the north and south, was always adorned by a coiled serpent placed directly in the center of the forehead above the nose. This symbol also comes to us from the great serpent balustrades of Angkor Wat. And on the Angkor Wat symbols, and in many other parts of India, including the serpent of eternal time upon which Vishnu sleeps in the ancient Vishnu Puranic literature, we always have a serpent with seven heads. Now, Plato tells us that the Atlantic continent was composed of seven principal islands, over which ruled seven princes. We've already learned of the seven heads of Ravan, king of Lanka, the Indian Atlantis. We have also constant reference to this peculiar septenary, the septenary of creating gods at the dawn of things. And we have the seven-headed Naga. We have the mysterious symbol, which many have firm conviction must have originally represented deity in the ancient Atlantean rites. We also know that this serpent appears wherever we have the motion of the so-called Atlantean or Mongolian culture. We have the mysterious serpents of Gobi. We have the serpent in the symbolism of Tibet and China. We have the serpent gradually metamorphosed into the five-clawed dragon, the imperial symbol of China, a strange and wonderful emblem. We know that the dragon lore and the dragon symbol came more and more to be associated with the magician and the sorcerer. We also have the mysterious serpents of Latin America. Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, was a good deity, not an evil one. We have the mysterious stone heads. We have the rattlesnake ceremony with the rattlesnake as the messenger between man and the earth in the rites of the Kichis and other tribes of the southwest part of the southwest part of our continent. We have it among the Zunis and the Hopis and even among the Navajo peoples. These symbolisms of the serpent with a raised head, we have generally associated with the serpent of evil. But even in the Bible, we are told, be ye wise as serpents and as gentle as doves, harmless as doves. The combination of the bird and the serpent, the feathered serpent of Gobi, Mongolia, the flying seraphs, the symbols always of the ancient initiate kings, the symbols of the secret masters of magic in ancient times. And it is believed that by this, the Druids, who received it also, and used it twisted as a serpent symbol around the Orphic egg, that among these ancient peoples, this symbol had to do with the magnetic field of the earth. To them, the serpent was the symbol of pure life. To them, it was also the symbol of energy and of power. And the control of power and the directing of energy seems to have had something to do with the rising wisdom of the old Atlantean savants or priests. There is the consistent and continuous report that among these peoples certain sciences were advanced until man, having attained to a level of knowledge greater than his morality, having come into a power greater than his virtue, turned this power to the exploitation of his own kind, and gradually, through skill, devised methods which unbalanced the natural equilibrium of natural elements, and as a result of that, loosed the great volcanic fires upon himself. When the priests discussed with Solon the mystery of the lost Atlantis, they told him that it was destroyed by fire, but that there would be another race rise that would be destroyed by an invisible power moving in the air. We have remembered this legend, we have thought about it, and we cannot but wonder if the strange power that brings death in the air is not close to some of the things that we are presently concerned with. Now, in the last 25 years, the problem of Atlantis has become of great importance. But it goes back earlier than that. I can say rather safely, I think, that from the time of the Neoplatonists of Alexandria to the rise of Francis Bacon in the 17th century, one heard very little about Atlantis. Men at that time were concerned with it only as the possibility of a land to be explored in the West. It came to be associated with the islands of the Hesperides. It became also the Blessed Land and the Land of Hope, and efforts were made to parallel it with the mysterious land to which King Arthur was taken after he was mortally wounded at the Battle of Camelon. Actually, however, philosophically, Atlantis was not given much consideration, except as a problem of possible crisis in navigation. However, with the rise of science, with the beginning of a new way of life, we see Lord Bacon beginning to sound certain warnings. We see him using the symbol of Atlantis as a means of distinguishing a new empire that was to rise in the Western Hemisphere, a world of science, a world of progress, a world built around the dawn of the great scientific, humanistic instrument of logic and reason, which we know today. In other words, the whole theory, the whole system, was locked in the concept of the great scientific method, the method by which we would learn to wrest the secrets of nature from her, in which we would have power, power perhaps more dangerous than we could possibly know. As time went on and man in the West became ever more scientific and ever more progressive in these things, the interest in Atlantis has correspondingly increased. It seems that perhaps this continent was submerged not only beneath the waters of an ocean, but within and beneath the subconscious ocean of ourselves. That somewhere in the subconscious part of our own nature, the warning of Atlantis still resides. And as our days of progress become more rapid, we become more and more conscious of a world that once vanished away, and the possibility of our repeating this catastrophe in our own generation and in our own way of life. If this is the case, it seems that a subconscious association mechanism is operating. For every day, the interest in the mystery of Atlantis increases, and this fatal interest is locked with the circumstances which caused the destruction of that ancient continent. How then shall we go a little further with the Atlantean religion? I think we may safely say that from the remnants that we have in various parts of the world, remnants of instruction, that what we call the mysterious temple of the Golden Gate on the ancient island of Posidonis is a kind of archetype of the mystery temples of the ancient world. This temple seems to have been the temple mother of all mysteries, the beginning of doctrines and secrets rising out of knowledge. There is an ancient belief that Atlantis could produce scientists, but could never produce a philosopher. That there was a certain element of reason that was deficient in these people. That they became masters of certain methods, which they preserved and perpetuated with utmost skill, but that they were never able to produce the great reflective power by means of which man recognizes the depth of personal responsibility. They were lacking in certain internal moral sentiments, which did not prevent their brilliance, but which contributed to their ultimate destruction. That they were destroyed for breaking the laws of the gods can mean a great many things, but let us imagine that the peoples who originally devised these accounts were reasonably intelligent. That we are not to assume that they were completely superstition-ridden. If we assume what ancient wisdom assumed, what the Hindus knew and the Chinese knew, and the Greeks and the Egyptians 5,000 years ago were well aware of, and have given us good record of their awareness, then when we say that a man disobeys the gods, it does not mean that he goes against the words of some godling on a throne. Disobedience to the word of God or to the will of God always means the breaking of natural law. That is what it always has meant and always will mean. The individual who has a stomachache is not punished because the gods take a particular dislike to him. He is punished because he has broken the laws which are the foundation of man's survival and the secret of his way of life. Therefore, an offense against natural law is the natural offense against God. The ancients were fully aware of this, that the laws of nature are the outflowing expression of the will of the Creator. That who breaks the laws of nature disobeys God. This was the belief of Pythagoras. This was the belief of Buddha. This is the great moral burden of the Institutes of Manu. That these great laws exist and will be obeyed. Now, how do we disobey the laws of God or the laws of nature? The ancients declared that the way in which we disobey is when we use the powers or the knowledge or the energies or the resources that we possess contrary to proper use. That the individual who uses well is rewarded, The individual who uses badly or abuses is punished. Punishment and reward, therefore, have nothing to do with the dictates of an arbitrary personal deity. They have to do with the individuals transgressing or keeping the laws of nature, which are the visible expressions of the will of God. Under these conditions, the Atlanteans, who were punished for disobeying the gods, were undoubtedly punished for some form of conduct or action which was contrary to the rules and laws governing the way of life under which they existed. According to the nature of the catastrophe as described by Plato and also recorded in other works, these Atlanteans grew great with pride. Well, pride might be regarded as the form of disobedience, but pride in itself produces only minor catastrophe. It is the proud man who suffers ultimately, but we do not assume that the proud man is going to be destroyed by a bolt of lightning. Pride, arrogance, and as the Indian reports suggest, a man believing himself to be greater than the gods, and thereby declaring himself to be free of their laws, making laws unto himself, believing that his own will is stronger than universal will, believing that his own desires are greater than universal desire, that this constitutes the disobedience referred to. This is also, of course, the basis of the rebellion of Lucifer. And in the rebellion of Lucifer and his destruction by the Archangel Michael, the casting of Lucifer into the abyss, together with the great monster and all this vast accumulation of heavenly stars, this battle between the Psychopompus of heaven, the army chaplain and master of the Lord, and Lucifer, seems to suggest again a parallel to the Atlantic deluge. The casting of Lucifer into the abyss seems to have to do with the humbling of great pride. Now, when we grow proud, it isn't the fact that we think we have better clothes or a better home or something that takes the dangerous form of pride. The pride that causes destruction is nearly always pride of mind, pride of will, and the kind of pride that causes man to lose his universal kinship with life around him. It is the pride of the Pharisee of the New Testament who gave thanks that he was holier and greater than others. But this pride even so is childish unless it inspires or impels the individual to an open rebellion. If it causes a people or a nation or a race to violate collectively the laws of the world in which they live, then such a people may well bring itself to destruction. The implication all the way through the story, the nature of the destruction, the record of the Egyptian priests, and all of these things seem to imply that the Atlanteans had in some way become possessors of secrets of nature, secrets which they were able to abuse, secrets the abuse of which constituted so vast an iniquity that in some way it unbalanced the natural equilibrium of the world and caused a terrible disaster. Now, that man's action can, under certain concerted circumstances, create disaster is not an unstudied phenomenon. For a parallel between pestilences, seismic catastrophes, earthquakes, tidal waves, and similar things, as these in their periodicity follow closely upon wars and civil strife, records of such parallels have been kept. And we know that every great social outburst of mankind on a destructive level has been followed by natural disaster. If, therefore, for some reason and in some way, this outburst was sufficiently great to cause a serious disturbance within the spiritual atmosphere of the planet, it is quite possible that this disturbance could have resulted in a catastrophe. Therefore, the assumption has been always among the writers and students of this phase of the subject that the Atlanteans in some way got hold of what we call science, some form of it. Something perhaps which has been so completely blocked from our minds that we cannot even find it again. By means of which they gained control of great creative energies. And by means of these energies, which they had learned to control, they abused and perverted this power, forming what was called black magic, which is said to have begun with them. And through their perversion, the transforming of the serpent of wisdom into the serpent of death, they broke the law, and the gods hurled against them this full weight of their wraths and displeasures, the gods being the offended laws, striking back at the offenders. This leads naturally to the next question. What kind of laws and how did the Atlanteans break these laws? What are we dealing with? We have no record or evidence today. Although we have legend, we have no proven record today of the mechanical skill of these ancient people. We have some intimations. Some things have been found that might possibly cause us to suspect that they had advanced considerably on the levels of mechanistic achievement. We have no absolute proof of this. We do have, however, from the old legends, that the evil one, the power of the adversary, the black magician who stole away the Vedas in India, the people of the world who had grown evil in the story of Babel and the Deluge, we have constantly in the ancient writings the concept of magic, of sorcery, of some kind of infernal skill with which man was able to perform these diabolical things which caused the wrath of the gods. As you go back into the great institutions of ancient religion, you find the records of the struggles of magic. You find arising out of the old ways, the conjurer, the necromancer, the wizard, the sorcerer. And these words we use today so broadly, so generally, so inconsistently, that they merely represent something out of a fairy story. We have no idea what these terms might imply if separated from a very prosaic and very inadequate comprehension of them. The old Indian systems of thought suggest definitely that the great tragedy of Atlantis was due to the procedure which led finally to the organization and integration of the human mind. That the mind was involved in this mystery. That in some way, the mind, by its abuses, or by secret formulas within itself, gained power over the energies of nature. That instead of building machines, these ancient peoples developed a kind of mentality, a mentality far beyond anything suggested by the extrasensory perception gamut, a kind of mind over matter, a kind of power of mind to dominate the action of natural law. This was perhaps a phase of will and yoga. This was an ancient belief, an ancient way of life, that man possessing the secrets of the use of mental energy, could by means of it attain any end or any purpose that he desired, and that therefore that which he would will to do, and that which through will he could accomplish, he had the right to do. Therefore, the utter autocracy of his own will and the skill to exercise that will. The story of miracles coming down from the gods of the past, deities who blasted mortals with a glance, deities who wiped out races with a word of power. All these things seem to suggest that at some remote time, man had a knowledge of the use of mind as a direct instrument of knowing, as a direct instrument by means of which he could control the operating forces of nature. Paracelsus declared in the 16th century that such power existed, that he had witnessed it, that it was not completely lost. And we have reason to suspect that a great many of the phenomena of Eastern magic and of strange ancient reports, like the magicians of Pharaoh's court, these things have to do with a kind of magia, a magic of mind projection, and that this could conceivably have been carried to a very high degree. That it is quite possible that these persons in the ancient Atlantean world were not so different, but far more skillful, and that in reality they were the glorified aspects of the shamans, of the various sorcerers and wizard mongers of Siberia today, that they represent the same type of power that we find in voodoo and in Africa, namely the mysterious ability to control minds, that they possess to a great degree this mental science, this science of forcing the universe to obey the will of man. This might well have been their arrogance. This type of skill, which we still regard as one of the highest forms, and which we hope sometime that we can develop, might have been the troublemaker long ago. There would be no fossilized remains of it. No need for inventions as we know them. We can remember how the gods of Greece walked through doors and appeared on earth at will, surrounded themselves with clouds of invisibility, traveled from place to place, came in dreams and visions, and vanished again. That these actions do not only sound like the gods of ancient Greece, but they sound like the ancient wonder workers and rishis of India. These powers of the prehistoric godlings were the powers that we attribute to the masters of magic and the adepts and arhats and rishis of the classical Indian culture. These are the ones who walked in the air. These are the ones who could speak at great distances and be heard, who could go around the world in the flashing of an eye. These were the powers that some way existed within man. We often wonder, and many peoples have wondered, why it is that primitive man today still possesses remnants of these powers, and the civilized man does not. That it is almost impossible, at least very difficult, for the average so-called cultured, educated, modern person to cope with the mystery of mental energy. He is accustomed only to a practical and prosaic way of life, and all these other things seem strangely morbid and fantastic. Is it quite possible that in some way that this blotting out of the internal power of the human mind to control the universe, forcing man to turn to the wise instruments when he knows he has better ones in himself, this turning of all things away from the cultivation of internals to the domination of externals, this self-forgetfulness this casting of the prodigal son into the darkness and the flesh pots of Egypt, is all of this some way mysteriously tied to the Atlantic disaster? Does it mean that archetypally, in some way at that time, man, for committing a sin against the Holy Spirit, received upon himself the curse of that sin, the curse which has locked the magic side of his own nature, so that it now comes to him only faintly and often dangerously in sleep or in dreams or in nightmares? We know perfectly well that the evolution of man, the faculties of a superior nature, should gradually take the place of those of an inferior nature. We know that the natural direction of man's growth now is the growth of his own internal resources. Yet we find him turning again to the outside. We find him substituting mechanistic procedures for the development of powers which the history of the world tells beyond doubt that man possesses of his own nature. Have these things been locked? Is this legend that Plato told us, then, the submerging of the Atlantean mind by a deluge within ourselves? Is this thing which we call the subconscious, the ocean that closed over the Atlantic world, has it something to do with the phases of our own soul? Has it something to do with the locking of the transcendental arts which man once certainly possessed, if we may believe even the most simple stories of our own scriptures? Unless we wish to regard all of these things as fables, and if we do that, what do we gain? We gain only a larger mystery than any of the others. So the old belief was that the serpent, which was the symbol of esoteric arts and always has been, that the serpent once stood upright, but was cursed and fell upon the earth to eat of the earth. That it was once the most subtle of all creatures, but it betrayed man, and as a result of this betrayal, it was punished and humbled. This serpent has something to do with the psychic life of the individual. And it also has some way a binding in with the ancient Atlantean kings. Thus, in the legends, we do not need to assume that Atlantis was destroyed by the premature discovery of atomics or something of that nature. Because what we call atomics today is nothing but man blundering outside of himself with laws that he should be working with within himself to find the natural and proper way to apply these energies for the unfoldment of his own consciousness, so that he shall truly know good and evil, which he does not know today. So our problem is that the evil of Atlantis, the magic of Atlantis, was very possibly and almost certainly, if there's any truth in the old legends at all, the result of man's premature effort to conquer by mind a universe which is actually a spiritual world. The effort to subdue or to subject consciousness to intellect. In so doing, placing the human ruler above the divine and making the gods the servant of man instead of man the servant of the gods. For this, the great punishment came upon him, the punishment of madness and destruction and death, the punishment that wiped away of civilization a great culture, leaving not a rack behind. Thus, the Atlantis myth, as Plato describes it, could well be of the greatest and deepest importance to psychologists and psychiatrists and all those who deal with the locked parts of man's internal dark life, the part that might well have been submerged or gone down in a great catastrophe in the very beginning of his existence. Supposing in an early struggle between will and consciousness, man set upon himself the whole psychic framework of his present psychotic pressure. That all our intensities, our neuroses, and our frustrations are due to an Atlantean catastrophe in ourselves. The locking and destroying of a psychic over-self that was sacrificed long ago and a still sacrifice to make possible the strange obscuration of values from which we have suffered ever since. Now, there's another interesting point that we might bear in mind, and that is that it is said that in Atlantis, there is a legend, that the Atlantean was left-handed. Now, just exactly what does that mean? If we are to study this a little bit, let us take writings of various kinds that are written from left to right and from right to left. Let us go back to the old idea. And we find in ancient religion the idea that those works which are the works of God shall be performed with the right hand, and those works which are surely the works of men shall be performed with the left hand. With the right hand man shall touch clean things, with the left hand unclean things. The right hand and the left hand, therefore, seem to have some bearing upon our consciousness. Count Lewis Hamann, Cairo, whom I knew many years ago, the great palmist, made a very simple statement based upon all studies of palmistry. He said the right hand in a normal person is read to represent the present state of the individual. The left hand is past. The left hand, therefore, is that with which he has been anciently endowed. The right hand is what he does with it. If we take this symbolism, Atlantis, the left hand, the left-handed man, that which is the ancient endowment, something that has come down, something that belongs to us, and something across the face of which has been drawn a veil. The same veil that divides every human being, not only from the past behind his birth, but also from the dark source which is behind his body and his personality. The ancient rituals of the right and left hand seem to be much concerned with this. For in sorcery, certain things had to be done with the left hand. Magic figures to call demons were done with the left hand. Magic signs to invoke angels with the right hand. The old sorcery goes on. There are some exceptions to this among some peoples, but the prevailing pattern is that this left hand is always the hand of the works that shall be concealed, that man shall not reveal to himself. This is the hand that doeth the works that the right hand shall not know. Let not the one hand know what the other hand doeth. And what the other hand doeth, in far as the ancient world is concerned, man does not know. He knows that he has come down through the veil. Why is there this veil of history? Why does everything that we seek to know about the story of man come up against a blank wall that corresponds very close with the destruction of Atlantis? Was there some psychic cataclysm at that time, not only visible but invisible? Was the principal part of this cataclysm invisible? Was the Atlantic story only a fable to describe a spiritual fact in the growth of man? However we wish to look at it, we know that we are in the presence of a very profound riddle. A riddle which will not be solved even if we discover the landmarks of an ancient continent. If we should tomorrow discover the ruins of the city of the Golden Gates, we are not sure even then that we possess the secret. Any more than Dr. Breasted was sure that we knew the secret of the Egyptian language simply because we had the Rosetta Stone. The possibility that Plato was a man of philosophic insight and initiate of the mysteries used this story for a totally different reason from that originally intended is possible and reasonable. Especially when we know that a story of parallel nature, obviously with double meaning, has appeared in practically every early religious writing of mankind. What then are we actually working on? Are we working merely upon this simple story, are we working upon something larger and more important? The Chinese tell us that at death, every individual passes through the Atlantean mystery. For in this, his objective life is submerged in the unknown. That Atlantis is repeated in each individual at the close of a life cycle. And also that every 25,000 years in the great Platonic year, the Chinese say, when the sign of the equinox passes into the house or sign of the fishes, we have the great night. Now actually, we are now, therefore, enjoying that blissful interlude, because the equinox is at this time taking place in the sign of the fishes. From about the year A.D. 325 on for over 2,000 years, the equinox takes place in the sign of the fishes, which is, according to the Chinese, the sign of the deluge. Their symbol for this is that it is the age in which the good man and his family must carry the truth across the darkness until the dawn of another world. They expand this, the I Ching, by explaining that in the day of darkness, when virtues fail, when is almost as in the Indian concept of the Kali Yuga, when all of the great values go into poverty, in what Plato calls the eras of sterility, the great ideals of the race languish, the great institutions of man decline, and in the words of the Hindu, every man who has an elephant shall be called a Raja. It is the time of power, the time of pretense, the time of materialism, and the obscuration, when again the book of the law is stolen by an evil demon and carried to the bottom of the ocean of oblivion. It is in that time also that the great being Vishnu, who is the savior of worlds, who speaks in the form of Krishna to Arjuna at the battle of Kurukshetra. Krishna says, when virtue fails upon the earth, then I come forth. And according to the ancient Chinese, it is in this age in which the good man and his family in the boat are going across the great sea of darkness that the deity in the form of the fish comes to guide the boat to the safe haven. Thus, apparently, the Chinese and the Hindus both recognize that the age of the fishes is the time in which the great ideals of man must be preserved and protected by a few, that they will not be popular, that they will not control, that the great and good things will struggle quietly and silently for survival, that in these days false things shall be called great, and great things shall not be known, but that by virtue of the grace of the divine power, the mysterious patriarch and his family, symbolizing those of noble insight, shall be carried safely across the darkness, and from their dreams and ideals shall come forth the progeny of a new world. This, accordingly, is also a Chinese concept of the Atlantis cycle. There is no doubt also that in the great Brahmanic year of India, the year composed of 4,320,000,000 mortal years, that this is surrounded by the great pralaya, the sleep of the gods, and that the Atlantic story can also bear upon the great dissolution that follows all cycles, the alternating days and nights of Brahma, the outpouring and the inflowing of universal life, and that in the inflowing, when the silence and darkness comes, then the seeds of life, the germs of life, the archetypes of life, move like a little ship upon the surface of the darkness and are carried across the oblivion to the coming of the new day, just as the soul and life seeds of the holy Arhat are carefully preserved and carried across the darkness from embodiment to embodiment. Thus, there are many allegories involved in this whole problem. And upon the greater, the lesser has been built. And upon the lesser, the greater has been conceived. These things the Hindus studied mathematically and astronomically, tying it all into one gigantic picture. And they believed that all things follow patterns. Therefore, that to possess the key to one of these great cyclic patterns is to understand the principle underlying all of them. By such concept and by such analogy, we have an eternal Atlantis myth, a myth which has to do with the dying of worlds. We have a small Atlantis myth which has to do with the dying of men. And we have between another Atlantis myth which has to do with the dying of races, with the endless changes in the forms and patterns of things. We also, in every instance, find that this dying is due to abuse, due to the exhaustion of resources. And perhaps, therefore, the Indian saint is not so wrong when he says that all dying is due to abuse, and that the individual who attains perfect contemplation and the perfect transcendence of consciousness over mind is immortal, therefore cannot sink under the ocean or go into the darkness of some lost world. There are so many ways in which we can approach this lesson. From the Greek side, the moral. From the Eastern, the Hindu and the Chinese side, the rational. The strange, deep involvement in law, in magic, in use and abuse, and of the great struggle of mind and matter, and finally the struggle of mind and consciousness. And I think that the great purpose of the New Atlantis would be well achieved if man can achieve the conquest of consciousness over mind, that he can free himself from the polarized existence of the mind, free himself from the strange delusion which has possessed him of so long, this delusion of power, this delusion of ambition, this delusion of possession. For Plato tells us, for these things the Atlantean died, because in the search of them he gained a skill which he used selfishly, becoming a black magician, accomplishing his end by compromising his relationships with the universe. It is by these ambitions also so fell the angels. It is by these same misuses that modern man has drenched himself and his world in blood since the beginning of history. If, therefore, this solution lies somewhere, it must lie within man. It must lie in the correction of the basic faults which destroyed Atlantis. And these faults which have destroyed every man and every woman since Atlantis. These faults of selfishness. These faults of the so-called victory of the mind with its fears, its hates, its grievances, its prejudices, its conceits, and its opinions, by which man has always defeated his search for truth and destroyed his quest of life. Therefore, the curse of the Atlantean has fallen upon us. The curse of our own mindness, the curse of egoism, as opposed to the universality of things which alone can solve our problem. Now, it's quite possible that in a moral world, all these legends were fitted together to contribute a great overtone to our scripture. But it is also quite possible that these legends relate back to a factual circumstance, which was the supreme example of everything implied, the first and dynamic proof that man, breaking the law, must perish. And certainly this has been the moral burden of the story since the beginning, and is still something which we can enjoy considering. And if this is the fact of the case, if this moral lesson is the deep one, if this struggle between mind and matter, which was lost in Atlantis and which we are fighting again today, is the true context of the story, then this drama is of the utmost concern to us as a guide to character and as a warning of what can happen if man refuses to correct these basic weaknesses which have always afflicted and distorted him. But our time is up, so we will continue with our discussion of Atlantis next week.